Hello and welcome to a new episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital money and helps you understand how digital assets and money will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Jonas and today I'm joined by co-host Stefan Grassmann. Hi Stefan.
Hi Jonas.
And in this particular episode, we are super thrilled to have Dr. Alexandra Hachmeister with us. Alexandra is Director General Digital Euro at Deutsche Bundesbank and thus responsible for the digital euro on the side of the German Central Bank. Welcome, Alex. It's a really great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. Really looking forward to our conversation, Stefan and Jonas.
Thanks so much. I'm also excited. So what we will cover today is we will discuss the digital euro. So for example, talk about which role the digital euro can play around Europe's sovereignty. We talk about where the digital euro project currently stands, where it will go. Also maybe what, Alex, your key lessons learned were of the project. And in the second half of the podcast, we will also talk about stablecoins and also how digital currencies generally may be used for corporate payments in the future. So let's get started. Alex, you joined Bundesbank after being more than 20 years with Deutsche Börse, if I'm not mistaken. How did it come that you decided to, you know, to join the public sector or to join central banking? What excited you most about Bundesbank when you joined in 2022?
Thank you for the introduction, Jonas. You're absolutely right. It's more than two decades at Deutsche Börse, which gave me deep insights into financial market infrastructure, so the backbone of all of it. And in 2022, I made, I think, a quite astonishing decision for the market, because moving from the private sector to the public sector is not a standard yet in Germany. Also, I highly recommend it, to be very clear. And at that point, I joined Bundesbank for a related but very different topic, and that was economic education and international relations. And these were topics that were actually very close to my heart. There was an opportunity at Bundesbank, usually doesn't get published to the private sector as well. So I just, you know, there was an open door and I decided I'll move through that one. While I was at Bundesbank, you know, the institution is very much evolving, and a strategy review was, you know, done a year earlier than usually. So the cycle of 4 years was reduced to 3 years. And as a result of that review, Bundesbank decided to put the digitization of its own currency at its strategic priority. And I would say then the decisive moment came, and I was very lucky that the institution came up and asked me if I would be ready to take over the responsibility to build up an own director general for that. And that was a very easy decision. I think there's not many more exciting topics than that. And it took me, I think, like nanosecond to say yes. And that's what I've been doing during the last 2 years.
And I guess as a European, let's say, in your heart, with also focus on education, I think, you know, that's both very, very relevant and important also when you, you know, work on the digital euro in your daily life, I could assume.
Absolutely. I think it is absolutely compelling. And that was also, and you asked that initially, why would you join a public institution? It's definitely the purpose of serving the mandate that Bundesbank has, the stability of the euro, and then delivering, you know, the digital form of the euro for, in the retail space, for whatever, 350 million people. I think that is just a gorgeous task.
Alex, when Jonas and me prepared for this one, we thought, okay, we will certainly dive deep into the digital euro. But before we do that, we thought, let's start a bit with the broader picture, with sovereignty. I think that's a term that drives us in Germany and in Europe generally. We have so many dependencies on many levels. But especially in the field of digital services, if you look at the cloud providers, if you look at GenAI with the dependency on ChatGPT and other models currently. Also, when we look into the payment sector, we have the credit cards, we have the last mile with Apple Pay and Google Pay. We have this dependency, many people using even PayPal or depending on services like Stripe. We wondered, how are you looking on that term of sovereignty regarding the payment system more generally? What do you think about that point? Is that a driving factor for all that you are doing?
Absolutely. And thank you for that question, Stefan. I think it is a very important factor these days. And I think you actually mentioned it from two dimensions. I think the first one is, generally speaking, how do we look at digital infrastructure, right? And I think we are fully aware, and this is a debate that goes across all industries right now, that, you know, 80% of Europe's digital technologies are imported, right? Can we fix this with the digital euro? Fully, no. as a central bank, we obviously focus on the topics that are in our responsibility. So when we look at the digital euro, sovereignty is a very important point for us. And I think you mentioned it. Most of digital euro payments today, when they're in the digital format, are executed on non-European infrastructures. And these are Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, you name them, right? And I'm not excluding anyone on purpose, to be clear. And I think what's striking me is that 13 out of 20 euro area countries do not have a national payment scheme. So either they have the possibility to use cash or they use a non-European scheme. And I think that is very striking from a point of sovereignty. If you believe that more than half of the countries do not have access to a fully European infrastructure. And that actually means also that a significant share of daily payments is routed through systems outside European control. And that is, you can look at it from a technical perspective and say, okay, that's a technical problem that we can fix, but it's a very strategic perspective as well. Because if you think that there could be decisions made outside of Europe, and that could be economically driven, they could be geopolitically driven, but they could have an influence if we are capable of, you know, transacting the way we want to, both as individuals as well as businesses. So obviously for us, the sovereignty aspect is very important and really the question that we're trying to solve here. So it is, let's put it that way, it is actually the digital euro, the way it is designed today, the way that we say we built a fully European infrastructure is actually trying to tackle that challenge. And maybe one aspect, because that is recently discussed very much in public, this is not, and I repeat myself, not about crowding out private sector, not at all. Right? And I give you an example for that. The relationship between the customer and the bank stays fully intact. As Bundesbank, we don't have any intention of having 80 million accounts or wallets in the digital world with Bundesbank. That's not what we do. We build the rails and the relationship stays with the bank and the bank offers its services on top of it.
Diving a bit into the digital euro, so how exactly does it help us to become more sovereign? What does it actually, or what do you think do the citizens think about that aspect? Is it also important for them?
That is a really tough question because and I give you a similar example. If you ask, and I include all three of us, if you would ask us on a scale of 1 to 10, how important is privacy for you? We would probably all say, oh, 10. Right? Or rather close to 10. We'd all say, oh, no, it's my data, you know, I should be in control of it. However, when we use payment schemes, we usually waive our privacy agreements, right? In particular with the non-European ones. And this is actually one aspect that the digital euro will provide to our citizens, right? As with cash today, it is about privacy also, about, you know, we're not going to sell your data. And at the same time, what is important to know, you know, as the euro system, as Bundesbank, we don't see any of the data that you provide. We only see pseudonymized data. So we can't really see the individual and the individual transaction. And this is how how the setup and the technological architecture is designed. It's not our intention, because that's another fear that sometimes is out there, to take control of anything that our citizens do. It's really to provide them an alternative. And I think the point is, what we're trying to achieve actually goes beyond convenience, right? It is very convenient for all of us, you know, to use your mobile phone when you go and buy your whatever coffee and or your watch even, you know, the younger ones, and I have two sons, you know, they're all with the technical gadgets out there. But the thing for us is that as central banks, we have the duty to think about what we need to do for any event. It doesn't mean that the citizen has always to think about, is everything that I'm doing safe? We have to make sure if any event arises that we are capable of delivering what our citizens need.
Maybe a follow-up question to the convenience point. From your statement, I derive that you want to be as convenient as current payment systems, because otherwise I think we agree that it's quite hard to get this kind of payment scheme up and running and accepted. So is that the goal, to be as usable or closely integrated, similarly to an Apple Pay? Is that the goal?
I would say yes. On the other hand, as I said, we don't see each other as a competitive endeavor. We see us as a complementary choice that we offer. And we actually expect that, you know, things such as we see with you know, the introduction of Vero's through API, we see actually a good possibility, you know, to combine the two in a very efficient manner. So I think you pointed or you hinted at something, you know, if your product is not convenient at all, no one's going to use it, right? Adaptation will be zero. At the same time, we are not a business, right? For us, it is not about grabbing market share. For us, it is about providing the infrastructure, and they're very happy if all the banks sit on that infrastructure and also promote their schemes that they have.
And I think I'm probably misquoting here, but I recently read a study that it says if the market is already pretty well served in some areas, a product need to be, I'm not sure now, 5 times or 10 times better so that people use it in the end. So, you know, to take this number with a grain of salt, but it really shows in the end you need, you know, you need a good experience that very, very well aligns with what we have in the market, because otherwise, for example, the tech-savvy generation may not use it, right?
I agree with you very much on that one. I think there is one clear advantage with the digital euro. I think today what you have to use as an end user, at least I do, I have several cards and several methods of payments that I use. And the digital euro is designed in a way that it is usable for all situations, meaning at the point of sale, also when I buy in the internet, also P2P. So I would actually get something that I can use in all relevant use cases, and it's the same product. I think that actually is a value add that you have with that. So you don't have to switch between different formats. But I think ultimately it is obviously, you know, the customer that decides. But I think there's one also important point to note. The merchants will play a very relevant role in, you know, in delivering this product, because they are the intermediary here. And I think in the public debate, they often get overlooked because they are also the stakeholder here that usually has to cope with different types of fees when it comes to different payment options that, you know, the customers can use. And they might have preferences for different payment instruments and also promote them then.
And they express their support, I think, plenty of times, right? So they are definitely a stakeholder group that are very supportive on the digital euro. When you listen to this, I think I've seen like Metro or some retail player really, you know, indicating very strong support. So I think for them, it's definitely a value add. And I also really liked what you just said, Alex, on this one payment solution. If you think about that, you have a credit card, you know, you can bring it now onto your phone, but it's still this card type of element. With PayPal, you can transact now also via, at the point of sale, but typically via an alias, right? And then you have MSEPA, you can do account-to-account payments. But if you had just one payment method that would unite all the features, you could pay with link, you can receive, you can pay initiated on and offline. That's, I think, from a product perspective, a really big value add. However, of course, also very difficult to build, right? We will talk about the Digital Euro project later on. I think it's not easy to get such a product, you know, really set up and launched to a European market.
Absolutely agreed.
We also wondered how European the infrastructure for the digital euro will be in the end. So how do you make sure that this really stays under European control?
I think, first of all, if you think of how we, in today's world, you know, deliver European infrastructure on payments, the infrastructure normally is provided by central banks, usually, you know, a team of central banks, one could say. It's called the 4CB, usually the four large central banks that provide, that build and operate, for example, the target services, right? It will be pretty similar with regards to the digital euro. So if you think of the digital euro, you know, being formed of different components, there are some components that are closer to the heart, I would say. For example, the settlement engine being the heart. This is something that you would only want the central banks to build themselves. However, the further along you get, or the further away you get from the heart, when it comes to AML, when it comes to a wallet, is that the core competency of central banks today? One would say no. So if you look at how, you know, we are organizing ourselves, we're actually making sure that, you know, the vast majority of the components that we deem very critical will be built by a alliance of 6 central banks. These are France, Italy, Spain, Austria, Lithuania, and of course the Bundesbank, right? So it's the 6 of us that will build and operate these components. And then you will have seen that it was published who was selected through the different procedures for the other components. So what you're seeing is that First of all, a strong part will be built by ourselves. And secondly, in the selection process for who could, you know, answer to the call for offer or for the other components, it was clear that these have to be European institutions. So there was a clear understanding that we want this infrastructure to be truly European. And I think what is also important to know is that, in particular, the operations will be done within, of course, Europe, right? And we will have three centers, but, you know, across Europe, where we will build and operate it.
Perfect. There are different voices that demand different priorities. So lately, we heard from the rapporteur of the European Parliament, Fernando Navarrete, who recognizes the private sector is working on achieving pan-European payment sovereignty through the interlinkage of existing European payment systems or instant payment-based schemes like Vero. And he mentioned that maybe just start with the offline version, complementing that private industry efforts. How do you think about suggestions like that to maybe reduce the grand scheme of the digital euro, which is obviously a very large project? And some from the private sector might say, okay, actually, we only bear the downsides of that because we are forced to interoperate, which will influence quite some IT roadmaps for the next years, I guess, when I talk to banks. How do you judge such statements?
Let me put that on different levels, okay? I think, if I look at the, let's take a look at the political and governance level of it. I think it is... we very much welcome that Mr. Navarrete published his report, because it means in the political process that this is the starting point for discussions, formal discussions in the European Parliament. And a draft report is a first and necessary step, and as such, generally welcome. Do I agree with everything that's in there? Most likely not. Right, and I'm happy to elaborate on a few of those aspects where I would say, well, I have a different perspective as a central banker, but I think it is very good to have a starting point, because we have seen how strong the progress is on the council side, and we need to get the report done to get into trilogue negotiations. I think the worst thing for everyone involved is if this takes too long. Because it means for banks, it's not clear what's going to happen. For us as central banks, it's not clear what's going to happen. So we need to move forward in whatever direction that goes, right? And I have to say that from my own experience in Brussels, I actually have trust in the process, right? So there will be strong negotiations. And the starting point that you just described is obviously quite, in some cases, quite far off from what the European Commission put on the table as their initial proposal. So what does this tell us? Intense negotiations are going to be expected, right? So this is, you know, probably just to describe what we look at it from a process perspective. I think the second aspect is, and I've discussed it with Navarrete in person, actually, my question was, how will you measure that the private sector was successful and then say we don't need a digital euro? And should we then, as central banks, wait and then come in? Because then we would lose years. And that is actually quite dangerous in terms of sovereignty. And he was very clear. He said, no, you shouldn't stop. It is more a possibility, from his perspective, to say, okay, banks can come in with what they are working on right now. Right. So this is also something that you need to consider. If you look through the report, it says, okay, offline should be there immediately as fast as you can for the online version. You know, let's see if the banking sector can succeed here. Right. So this is a bit of how he has phrased it. I think if you only start with an offline version, you're actually modifying the mandatory acceptance, and that would significantly weaken the digital euro. So I don't think that the whole concept of a digital euro and the thinking, yes, is sovereignty at one point, but the other is also that our citizens are changing their payments behavior. And as I cannot pay with cash in the internet, an offline version obviously also doesn't work in the internet, right? And if I want to provide to my citizens an opportunity to still pay the central bank money, I can't do it only with an offline version. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't cater for all use cases. So if you ask me, is that good enough to say, let's start with one and let's see if the others figure it out? My answer would be, as expected, I would guess. Not really, to be honest, right? But I would also like to make another comment here. I think what I really don't like about the debate is that it is positioned in a way that it is banks against the central banks. And I don't see it that way. I actually believe that if we hadn't had, you know, the proposal on the table, nothing would have moved at all, because we haven't seen it during the last 25 years moving anything in that field. We have issues that we need to fix across all 20 relevant member states. And the banks are not present in all 20 member states. And it's not easy to build that reach. But if you think of it, that you have the rails built by the digital euro that you can sit on top, and you have the mandatory access, it can actually help the banks to broaden their reach and actually be more competitive. So I actually, and this is what I try to emphasize in the dialogue that I have, I would like to try to get us out of, you know, the different ends and get us closer together and really getting to the point where we agree we can do this together.
And I mean, it's kind of a philosophical question, I think, if you would say the private sector could, you know, also provide a fully sovereign payment infrastructure, because I'm often, you know, or let's say opponents would say, I mean, you know, they tried it for 15 years now to create some kind of a PayPal killer and it didn't work. And the proponents would say, but Vero is now here, so it would work, right? So I think it's very, very challenging to see what's now right. But I liked what you said, Alex, is that you could work together with these private sector initiative. And maybe because I have the feeling also from our audience, we often think Digital Euro, for example, versus Vero or some other initiatives. How do you think these two initiatives or also other ones, right, could work together? So how could private and public sector work together?
And fully agree here. And I think we will see intense negotiations now. But I really hope that during the year of 2026, we get past that, right? So that we can ultimately deliver. Because I think it would be better for Europe this time to be prepared and, you know, not be reactive if anything happens. And time is really of essence here. So I think it is good that everyone is looking at it and looking at it intensively. I think it would be worse if no one cared.
Imagine your heater not only keeping you warm, but also earning you Bitcoin at the same time. That's exactly what the Ofen 2 by 21 Energy does. This isn't science fiction, it's Austrian engineering. The Ofen 2 is essentially a Bitcoin mining heater. It converts 1,000 watts of electricity into 100% heat, heats rooms of up to 50 square meters, and while it heats, it uses the energy twice. It mines Bitcoin for you. And the best part? True plug and play. You don't need any technical knowledge at all. Just plug it in, connect it to the 21 Energy app via Wi-Fi. Done in 3 minutes. It's whisper quiet and looks absolutely stunning. Premium steel design, made in Austria. Instead of just consuming energy, you get cash back in Bitcoin. Use your energy twice. Get the Ofen 2 at 21energy.com.
I think we already jumped into our next sector somewhat, and what you said, Alex, brings us to a next interesting question regarding the timeline. I think if you ask three people, what do they think, when will we see a digital euro? What's your take? How long does it take to bring it to life for the ordinary citizen?
Okay, I'll start with a few ifs, okay?
Okay.
we expected that.
I think, first of all, what you have is you set up a timeline of how you want to develop the infrastructure, how you want to include piloting in it, because you don't want to build for 3 years and then start testing. So you want to do that early on, and see how you can look at different use cases. So the plan that we have made so far would, under the assumption, and this is my big if, that we get, that we get to a political agreement by the end of 2026, we would already see piloting in 2027. So that's not so long away, because I think it's not that we should wait years and years and years. We should be really, you know, moving ahead. And I think this is, if we just talk retail side, I don't know, we can talk a bit later, a bit about when we talk about stablecoins, also about the wholesale side, we will be even much faster there. But we don't need a legislative process there. So that is the big difference that we have here.
I think we totally agree on this political dependency that we need to go next year to go further swiftly. But what about the banks? So I think you have your own timetable for the core solution, let's put it like that. But our audience might know that we have these overflow rules, that you might have just 1,000 digital euro in your wallet, but you can spend much more. And then somehow magically the money needs to flow in from your account, et cetera, et cetera. I think speaking from a technical perspective, when we talk to banks, usually they have the next 2 years of a pipeline for their IT stuff. And now you come along and say, short term, or when we know end of next year that oh yeah, it's finally happening, then some IT department has to put that into place for every bank that's affected by that. So this might take much longer, I guess. Or how do you see that? What do the banks tell you when you I guess you have these conversations with them? So do you put pressure on them, or how does it how do they react to that aspect?
I think that's a very fair aspect that you mentioned, that it's a scarcity of resources that we all face, and that we always, and that basically leads to prioritization, right? I think, first of all, we are, and that not only personally me, but in a very structured manner as the euro system, in constant exchange with all the stakeholders. That is through different user groups, that is to write the rule book. So these are all discussions where we are intensively working on all of these topics. We will start. The idea of piloting is to early on provide technical information how things are going to work, right? Not to say, okay, we have rolled out now, now you have whatever 6 months to connect and then you have to be ready. This is not how we are approaching it, to be really clear here, right? I mean, that is, I know that from 20 years ago, that's probably more, you know, former style of development of technological systems. That's very different these days because agile approaches are now the way to go, right? You trial something and then you discuss and then you see if that works, yes or no. I think you rightfully mentioned, for example, the waterfall, because there are definitely some tricky questions that need to be solved. How do you do that? You know, how do you organize on a technical level the identification that, okay, there is still the waterfall is approved, so I can add in more money, and that should be seamlessly in, you know, not being felt by the consumer, to put it that way. So we're not talking nanoseconds, but you know what I mean, right? It needs to be so efficient that as a user, when I have approved using a waterfall on my account, that I don't feel it, right? So obviously, I agree with you, there are many technical challenges that we're facing. But I think we have been thinking about those. We're not just starting that, right? We have been in discussions now for more than 2 years. We just finished the preparatory phase, right? So the investigation. So we're now moving more into the first starts of implementation. And there has been a lot of debate already going on, also on the technical level. And that is needed. Of course, when it comes to priorities of IT resources, I think this is always something that you will have to ask yourself. It's the same thing with any other project that you do, also investing your resources into Vero, for example. I think there's one aspect. The interesting thing with the digital euro is that we're talking about open standards for the banking sector, right? That they can apply. That means basically everyone is, you know, kind of, let's call it docking onto the same thing. And that should in itself provide some efficiency. If you think, for example, of a model where you would say, and this is part of the argument that we have right now by the banking sector, you know, let's make it all interoperable. That can actually be quite a nightmare, right? I mean, trying to get two systems interoperable and the third one onto it, etc. So it might be actually very efficient also from a technical perspective to provide a technical layer with a clear standard for everyone, the same to use. But it will be a challenge, of course.
So yeah. So it's really the big if when the regulatory draft will come. And I also hope really it's 2026. If it's intense discussion, of course, it could take longer, right? Because we know that the parliament, I think it wants to agree on a position. I think it's May next year. So this would mean just 6 to 7 months, but fingers crossed. So I guess we will see. But also regarding these 2.5 years or 3 years until the potential launch in 2029, what is then, Alex, like the key priority? So you mentioned the pilot, you mentioned the rule book, right? You know, which further key priorities does the Euro project have in this phase or in this next phase now?
I think it will be definitely to get everyone on board. I think that for me is personally a key priority, right? We have very different stakeholders. And we have to make sure that we get to the point where we are aligned and really start working together. I think that is, for me, an absolutely key priority, besides the legal process, of course. As I mentioned earlier, I think really thinking about how do we make this vision work for Europe, also in terms of thinking more of public-private partnerships.
So really stakeholder on board, value, you know, what concrete value does it give? And how does it maybe also contribute to the broader European vision on sovereignty, on the future of Europe? So all of these kind of topics.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Now, of course, some people might also wonder, like, you know, what's the Bundesbank now doing here? Because it's often said the ECB is doing, but of course it says Eurosystem. So people familiar with the term would know that also Bundesbank is involved. But maybe you can share a little bit more light on, you know, what you basically as a national central bank, as the Bundesbank, work on the Dutch euro, maybe also what's, you know, on your pipeline and on the roadmap for the next, until a potential hopeful launch at some point in the future.
I think in summary, I would say a lot of work. But
I can imagine.
But let me describe it a bit, because you are absolutely right. It's sometimes hard to distinguish what is ECB, what is the euro system, what is then a national central bank. All the national central banks of the euro era form the euro system, right? And all the systems are built and operated not by the ECB, but by service providers from the euro system. And these service providers tend to be the large central banks of the euro system. Bundesbank is the largest central bank within the euro system. So we are always part of those teams that build, you know, the new infrastructure. So what I have on my plate are different things. And we call that, you know, the service providing role that we have. I have that in my team as well. And the way we are approaching it is through the alliance. So the alliance has written down their offer, proposed it to the euro system to take a decision, is that what the six should build? And they have approved it. We have negotiated in between and they have approved it, right? So we are really, one part of my team is really in the service provider role.
Okay, so really building basically the back-end infrastructure, the operating platform for the euro.
Absolutely, building and operating. Yep. We are also at the same time, while we are a service provider, we are part of the euro system that says what they want, right? So we also provide the input to a certain extent, right? So this is also an important part. And in that role, for example, we are also the, I call it the national service provider for our institutions when the rollout is happening. Right, because you will have, once you know the system is ready and you have the rollout in the different countries, it is the national central banks that have the national service desk, as we call it, that serves their own institutions in their country. Right, so this is another thing that we then have to do. Right, and then there is obviously the work that we do quite intensively. What we always call the ecosystem. And we have talked a bit about the relevance of stakeholders, explaining what we do, why we do it, you know, handling all the myths that are out there, that anything like, you know, we are going to abandon cash, which is complete nonsense, for example. But there is also another work that we do that is more, I would say, on the policy side and on the communication layer to the outside world as well. So it's very different aspects that you would find in my team that we have to cover. And that means I have very different experts, right? I have someone who is a techie, as you call them, right? But I also have someone who does strategy. So it's very broad.
What we wondered when we prepared the question, would your role also be to support your clients like banks or PSP intermediaries? So once we go live with these systems, how does that look like from your current thinking? How deep can you support these users, these professional users of your system?
That's a very good question. I think what you have to take a look at is different service levels that you have, right? And that can be in terms of technical service levels, and in terms of, we have to make sure that there's availability of 24/7. That means anyone has to be able to reach us 24/7. That's not the citizen who has to reach us because they go through their bank, but all our institutions that we're connecting have to be able to interact with us. So what we're doing is here, we're setting up different types of service desks, right? And coming with Stefan, as you with a technical background, there's obviously level zero, level one service desk, depending on what type of whatever problem, incident, or anything that you're facing. So this is something in terms of when we are up and running, how we are, of course, going to support the smooth running of the whole infrastructure, jointly with the market, of course, right? But then there is the part before you are live, up and running, right? And this, I think, is...
That's the more important part from my perspective. So you need to start, you know, I think it's a coordination problem from my perspective. So it's like a 0-to-1 movement. So you want to be accepted everywhere with a digital euro. So nearly every merchant, every bank should support it at a certain point in time. And that puts a lot of pressure on the resources or the human resources that you actually have, because everybody might need help at the same point in time. Or do I get that wrong? Do you plan a staged rollout, or how will that look like?
I can't share an exact plan right now on that, but I would assume that you would rather go in waves, right? This is what you also do when you do piloting, right? You start what works, you find out what doesn't work as well. You will ultimately have to decide, you know, will all use cases be available at the same point in time by everyone in every country at the exact same time, yes or no? I think these are questions that we will have to, you know, lay down in a relevant roadmap. From my own experience, and I'll take off my central banker's hat for a second and go back to my former life being part of a financial market infrastructure, what we are talking here is market readiness. And I think that's a key to success for an infrastructure rollout. So I'm absolutely with you, Stefan, that this is something where we have to put a lot of brain into. But I've also seen, you know, in prior days, you would have a simulation that is close to production. You realize everyone can connect to the Zemo, and then you can later on say, okay, they should be capable of connecting to production, for example. I don't think it is the exact same thing today, but it's pretty close. And this is why you do piloting, for example, right? It will allow you to test out things. Exact planning, hard nut to crack, but I think a really fascinating problem to solve, actually.
Absolutely. Sounds like a very tough one, actually. I think rollout is much, much harder than the building of the thing, because you have to coordinate so many.
Yeah, no pressure. Thank
so many
you.
Institutions and people.
But good news is you have experience, you know, with like as a euro system rolling out the euro in different countries,
yes.
Right? So I guess in a different form, of course, you have done similar rollouts.
And I agree with you. There's one important aspect. I mean, if you look at, you know, more than 25 years back now on the rollout of the euro, it was very important, you know, the starter pack. Everyone loved it, you know, touching for the first time your coins and everything. That was the moment I think that most of the people realized this is really happening.
But that part will be very hard with the digital.
But this is, and there we get the other nut to crack. This is, how do we explain? And I get that when I, you know, I don't only talk to bankers or to merchants, but I also go out and talk to the public. And I often get the question, okay, can't you show me the digital euro? Yeah. I mean, we're doing this right now digital. No, I can't. I can't directly. I can explain to you how it works. And we will need to find a compelling way to communicate about the digital euro.
Yeah. Yeah. Very important, I guess. Our time is running. We need to get to the next little section. And I think we often talk about retail and wholesale scenarios, but in my perspective, we often forget about the corporates. And we wanted to ask some questions about the corporates. What's your general take on corporate usage of the digital euro, Alex?
I think, first of all, how the commission proposal is designed today and how it is written today, this is not... I would say for mass scale adoption in the corporate world, right? That's not how it is designed. It is designed as a product that is a complement to cash, right? For the citizens. So does today the way it is designed deliver for the corporates? Not yet, I would say. because I think the interesting thing, and this is what we're doing, and we are very supportive of any B2B cases, to be very clear. As Bundesbank, we see the strong need for our industry in Germany, you know, to think about what is also solving their issues. I described in the beginning what we are trying to solve right now in the payment sector for the retail side. That's not the exact same issue that the corporate side has. So the question that we will have to answer, and this is probably somewhere in between retail, wholesale, and new money forms that we see, is what do corporates really need, and what can, you know, how can we serve them best? Corporates also today, as you think of the digital euro as a complement to cash, corporates don't run around and pay in cash all the time, right? Obviously not. So what they do today, they use commercial bank money, right? And when it gets cross-border, you get the whole discussion around the correspondent banking system. And is there any inefficiency? There is cost attached to it, et cetera. So, and this is not anything that a digital euro as it is designed today for the retail side can solve. If you look at wholesale CBDC and what we're doing there, wholesale CBDC is intended for large financial transactions. And that is in a, I would say, well, it's probably not a good word, but it's more like a closed shop. Right? There are limited participants in there. And to be very clear, the private sector is not a participant today in the target services. Right? It is banks, and banks we supervise. So the whole point for me is, when I look at it, and then when I look at the whole debate right now, is can we imagine how the financial sector and the financial market infrastructure will evolve also to cater to the needs of the corporate sector? And we're doing that on the retail side as well. We have our own workshops on the visionaries and pioneers. We're really going down to understanding, is there something how we could further develop on the retail side that could help at least part of the corporates?
So if I understood you correctly, Alex, what you were saying is basically, I mean, A, currently most corporate payments are in the private space, so the private sector could also come up with solutions. I'm currently now looking into maybe tokenized deposits and stablecoins. And secondly, that also potentially the digital euro could address some of the use cases in the future. I mean, depends on the regulation and the use, right? But, you know, did I get this right, what you were saying?
Absolutely, Jonas. Absolutely. I think when I look at the world, there's retail, wholesale, and then there is the corporates, right? And the whole point is, what type of money is going to be relevant for their use case? And there is probably not wholesale CBDC the answer, or digital euro for any case, but for some cases they might be. And for others, there will be new forms. And this is why we also have this intense discussion right now around stable coins and tokenized deposits, actually addressing the specific use case. This is the most discussed, is about cross-border payments. And this is probably also the most relevant use case for a corporate.
Do you think we do enough for that? So when you look at the economical situation in Europe, we are struggling with a lot of stuff. And actually, the corporates are maybe the most important stakeholder these days, that they need to become healthy again, that we get an uptick in the economy. And do we support this stakeholder group enough?
It depends on who you ask, probably, right? Probably, is there ever enough, right? I think the whole point for us is we actively seek the dialogue with the industry, and we really try to understand what their issues are. But we have ultimately also to decide, can we solve them? Or is there anything else that can solve them? But then we might actually even have influence on that, right? So for us, it is very important, and you will have seen me at a recent conference with the BDE, so the Federation of the German Industry, where we jointly were discussing exactly those topics. Do we have an answer to all of them? No. But for us, it is really a high priority on the agenda to work on all of these topics. But again, coming back, I think it is today they are served by the banks through commercial bank money. And the whole point is, are they going to come up with an offer for them that, you know, provides those efficiencies that the corporate sector is seeking here?
Well, maybe that leads us to the next section regarding stablecoins. We also wanted to include this here, despite your focus on the digital euro. We see this enormous rise of USD-dominated stablecoins. I just was in Singapore at the FinTech Festival. I think you were too. I think I was on stage shortly after you. And I think they made the agenda, actually, of the USD stablecoins. And everybody seems to try to respond somewhat to the whole action that's coming from there. Do you think our response regarding the stablecoin aspect is good enough? Could we do more? Do we support these European stablecoins enough? Has the Bundesbank any role in there? Or do you say, okay, that's the private sectors, others have to solve that issue?
No, that's definitely not the answer that would say others have to solve that issue. And I agree with you. I think it was basically talk of the town, right? But I think what I also realized was that although stablecoins were talk of the town, also were tokenized deposits. So I think the whole question was on what type of instrument are going to be the digital form of today's commercial bank money, right? And you know, what we have in terms of deposits. So the question is, what is going to be the next level? And I think, interestingly, if you look at it, Europe has a regulation, and we had a regulation before the US had their regulation. But we didn't see, you know, a lot of stable coins denominated in euro, you know, being issued. I think the interesting thing is when you look at where do stable coins come from in the US, it is the cash lake for crypto assets. This is how they evolved. And the big question that they will have to answer is not, do we have a regulatory framework, which is absolutely needed and Genius Act is therefore. I think the interesting thing will be to see, do they really deliver on the promise outside of this particular use case when it comes to cross-border transactions, right? This is the question that will need to be answered, because that is the way that they can ultimately scale, right? Because I would say, coming back to what you asked, is this relevant to me? When it comes to being the cash leg of crypto assets, we have no intention of central bank money being the cash leg to crypto assets, right? No. But we look very strongly at the topic of stablecoins when it comes to how are they denominated, who is using them, for what use cases are you using them? Could there be any type of, I would say first round effect, but a second round effect, for example, if stable coins become really relevant, this could lead out to, you know, loss in liquidity in banks' balance sheets. This is, of course, a strong concern for us. So there might be secondary effects that we really care for, right? So having said that, we see this topic is absolutely relevant for us. At the same time, of course, we get a lot of questions on should we adapt European regulation, in what way should we adapt it, etc. Of course, we are looking at it, right?
I think there are two critiques regarding the ECB and the central banks to that. One is, it seems like the digital euro is the answer to US dollar stablecoins. And I think this shouldn't be the case, but I think the perception in the market is like that. And that's a question of communication, I guess, how we respond. And the other thing, I know that firsthand, which is true for Europe and Switzerland, there is no business case for stablecoin issuers because of the rules, actually. So if you look at the US dollar stablecoins, they can work with the treasuries, they can earn on that interest. We put strong regulation that most of the reserves need to be in bank deposits. And if you don't start, you can't judge how successful or how relevant the euro stablecoin might be in the end. And I think both aspects are a bit in the realm also of the Bundesbank. How would you react to this little critique on these two
I think you mentioned it, the first aspect that you mentioned. I think it is whenever we are in public discussions, I think except for a handful of experts who do this on a day-to-day basis and have to think about it all the time, it's really hard to say. And I often start my explanations by saying, okay, this is retail, this is wholesale. In retail, our answer, the digital euro, is to changes in payment behavior that we see and the need for sovereignty, basically, and delivering efficiency, less fragmentation, you name it, right? But that is retail. Do I see, you know, a a big use case for stable coins in retail? No, I don't. So it cannot be the answer. We are answering another problem, right? If I look at the wholesale side, we do wholesale CBDC for a clear reason. Today, large financial transactions are settled in wholesale central bank money. And central bank money, there's a good reason for it, because it's basically the risk-free settlement asset for everyone, right? We have to make sure that while, you know, the financial sector evolves and while the assets become digitized, that we deliver and, you know, rise to the occasion. If the asset side changes, we might want to adapt our cash leg as well and make sure that large financial transactions, as they are settled today in central bank money, settled in the future in central bank money. So wholesale CBDC for us is a very natural way of evolving as the market evolves. And at the same time, we allow the market also to innovate. So stable coins, as I said, are for me more a competitive product to what we have today in the commercial banking sphere right now. So the question is, if they can become relevant, can they have any effect on the stability as a second round effect? And this is where we really start looking into it. So yes, as Bundesbank, I personally spend some time on that topic, even today, you know, not just in this conversation. So while we might not, as central banks, you know, talk about what we do all the time, we take this very serious, to be very clear here.
And that's good to hear. And also good to hear your view on how stablecoins and the digital euro may compete or may not compete, because we discussed this in this podcast so many times. Actually, I personally found this very misleading, that also some, you know, ECB representatives really said that this is a response to US dollar stablecoins. I thought this was really, I agree with you. It's kind of more, you know, it's sometimes overlapping, but not everything. So it's not the response, because you mentioned that the sovereignty is the reason and some other arguments. But maybe one last question to stablecoins. You mentioned a potential negative impact, like on the financial stability, you know, in times of turmoil. You also mentioned the importance of central bank money for settlement. Now, of course, the Bank of England is going into an interesting direction, right? Because they will now allow a stablecoin issuer to access basically the central bank balance sheet. Yeah, this will basically mean that you could say, this stablecoin is not just backed with government bonds and bank deposits, but also with central bank money, which will, of course, be, you know, the riskless form of money we use for settlement. I discussed that with Ulrich Binzel in a previous podcast, and he was also saying, you know, this will not change short term, but who knows? So, if I understood him correctly, but maybe Alex, what's you know, just between us, what's your perspective on this topic? I know it's very controversial.
Thank you. And I would say I would agree with Ulrich, not surprisingly, on this thing. And I think, first of all, and I'm sure Ulrich said the same, we usually, as central banks, we don't comment on policy decisions of other central banks. I think, again, what we do is, we are actually in a very open exchange amongst central banks, because we truly believe that we can learn from each other and that markets are different and that there's always or usually very good rationale for the decisions that they take, right? So I've had, prior to that decision, some conversations with the Bank of England, and I continue my dialogue there, understanding what their rationale is. I think from the proposal, what I am, and I'm not into every detail of it, but I understand that the access to central bank money is a so-called light access, putting it that way, because you don't get, you know, really access to interest on it. So you basically get access to it, but, you know, if it's 40% or even more where you can't get any interest on it, that's usually not how you get the business case, right? So I think, again, and I haven't looked at every detail of their proposition yet. I'll definitely do that. I think you have to look at all the tiny details, right? Because it is not comparable. I at least how I read it right now, it's not full access. And that might go more in Ulrich Binzel's direction of saying, you know, there might be something in between. I think at this point in time, we wouldn't, you know, we are not ready to say, okay, we're going in that direction. But as I said, I mean, we're continuing our analysis and we learn as well.
The interesting thing for us as interested observers, let's put it like that. Yeah. So Mika was the first and set some rules for Europe. Then Genius came along and made it more attractive from a business case to invest the reserves into treasuries. Like actually Tether became big. Yeah. So they actually make a very strong business out of that, which is very, very hard for a European stablecoin. Now, Bank of England comes along and takes part of the counterparty risk for stablecoins away with that feature. That's at least I read it. So it makes them even more competitive from my perspective, especially when other regulators look at that and maybe copy some of these features, which I would expect to happen if there's a geopolitical competition over time. And that's what we are in. And just one comment from my side, I don't expect an answer. I think what we can learn from Singapore is that it's not only about consumer protection, making sure that there's enough safety for a bank run, etc., but we also need to get started. And sometimes we Europeans always think from the end. So if we are successful, then we need to protect everybody. Yeah, but if there's no euro stable coin that's in play, then you don't need to protect anybody. And that's where the US is actually much, much better than us, yeah, to get things going and then regulate while we go and protect everybody. I think that proves currently as a quite competitive strength when we compare that to our own regulation and behavior. And that's what I, as a consultant in that field, yeah, I feel with these entrepreneurs who try to make a business out of that whole thing. And this is actually really hard at the moment.
I agree with a few remarks you made. Definitely, I think being in Singapore is very inspiring because they definitely look at it from a different angle. I think we just talked about the mechanics of using it right now. I think what we shouldn't underestimate is when we set up Mika, so when Brussels did that, we basically had in mind this is a new form of digital money. It's a new instrument, right? When you look at how Genius Act was set up right afterwards, you know, there was already mass adoption for crypto assets. It has much more of a political intention. And this is obviously another aspect, whereas euro system were concerned, because when it comes to the intention, it was clearly stated several times of, you know, further dollarization. For us also, the international role of the euro is very relevant, right? We're the second largest reserve currency. And our capability of having functioning monetary policy that needs a transaction and a transformation mechanism, right, also depends on the relevance of our own currency, right? So there are many aspects that we have to consider. There are technical aspects that we look at, but there is obviously also political aspects that we take very much into consideration. And I don't think we are, and we're actually not done with our thinking.
Very good. Thank you very much for that, for these open words. We went a little bit off script here, but sorry for that.
No, but it's really, really good. And maybe to round this up, because as always, time is really flying. It was a lot of fun, Alex. And we have prepared basically three statements where you would like to get your comments on. You know, you can just simply indicate that you agree or that you disagree, or you can also add a comment. So whatever you prefer is fine for us. So it's three statements. And so the first one is the digital euro will go live in 2029.
Clear, it depends, as I said, if we get, you know.
That doesn't count.
No, okay, so under the assumption that we have the legal text in 2026, I'm tempted to say yes. But okay, wholesale
this
will
is a
be
little
much
bit of
earlier,
cheating,
right?
But it's
wholesale
fine.
Will be already in 2026 next year.
Yeah. Okay, understood. Then the second one, the digital euro will see massive adoption by 2035.
As a citizen, I might say I would love that. But I said earlier, you know, we're not the private sector. So for us, it's not a business case. For us, it is providing a reliable infrastructure. So it's, for us, it's not about mass adoption. We're a complementary product, not a competitive one. So, mm-hmm. No.
Mass adoption would be
like, you know, chunk, really big market share, I would say. No.
Like massive adoption, mm-hmm. Yeah. It depends how you define it. So.
Depends.
But okay, we lock this in as a no. And the third one is the digital euro and euro stablecoins will coexist.
For the time being, yes. You know, different use cases, different forms of money. And not just those two. There will be many more, right?
Yeah, and you talked about public-private partnerships, so I think this is really not not surprising to us. So, Alex, thanks so much. It was a really, really fun episode. I personally learned really a lot for this. I guess it was very relevant also for our dear listeners. Maybe like the last question, when people would like to learn more about the work you are doing, the work you at the Bundesbank are doing, or you personally, like, where can they, you know, follow you, reach out to you? What's the best kind of channel for that?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think you find me on LinkedIn. That's a good way to connect and to learn more. And I think we're actually pretty good with our webpage. I know that is boring to say go to our webpage. But for example, if you're interested in tiny details about what we have been doing on the wholesale side with the trigger solution, you can find everything, every detail on that page. You just have to take a look. So we are very transparent. Everything's there.
Perfect. And this is really something I have to say for the whole euro system. It's really great. I appreciate the transparency because so many central banks are just not transparent at all. And I think this really helps a lot everybody to understand and also to get them on board and educated. So a big shout out to that. So again, thanks so much. Also to you, dear Stefan, for joining. It was really a pleasure. And of course, dear listeners, thanks for joining this episode. You made it until the end. If you like this podcast, as always, of course, refer to your friends, your family, whoever you think is interested in the future of money and needs to learn about these topics. And yeah, with this, I want to close and say thank again for everybody and see you next episode.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.